I want to talk about interventions because I think it's very important in recovery ministry, if we can, to develop skills that support the work of the families and being able to effectively intervene in a way that emphasis on effective is a super high priority for me, because it's one of the most important and necessary things that families can ever do. And so I'm very passionate about that. I have a lot of very strong feelings about it. I may be wrong, but I'm very certain. So that could be a fatal combo, couldn't it? Think about the average family that comes to a recovery ministry. Maybe you're getting them and it's their first rodeo. Maybe you're getting them very early on in the process, but that's unusual. Most people, when they enter into recovery ministry or begin looking into getting the kind of support they need, most people have been in the process of the spiral down of substance use disorder and its effects on the family for quite a while, because it's mysterious. It takes a while to figure out what the problem is. So a lot of times what we get is families who don't have the financial resources to pay several thousand dollars to have somebody come in and do a professional intervention. And there are plenty of materials out there that would suggest that with the right kind of support, we may not need that. Now, that being said, there are a lot of families that need it. And if families have the funds to hire a professional interventionist, that is freaking awesome. And there's some really good ones out there, and go at it. But for many of us who have had people in and out of treatment for a really long time, maybe we've already dipped into our 401k to the point where we just can't do that anymore. And if, as a recovery ministry, we can have some skills to be helpful, that would be really, really great. Scott and I, in our ministry, do that with families. And we will take days, weeks, and months working with the family to help them understand. And remember too that we have in our ministry a Thursday night family education program where we're continually bringing speakers in to educate families about the whole process of recovery. And so we have a lot of elements in play at North Star that bring a lot of voices to the table to help families choose from a wide variety of options that are often confusing and sometimes completely priced out of anybody's pocketbook to utilize them. In order to be able to do that, though, we need some training. We need to be careful that we do not accidentally cause harm. I would say that in church work and church ministry, that we have some of the same problems that face families who need to intervene on one they love. Some of the work is very counterintuitive and kind of goes against the grain of what we as churches or faith-based communities have really been trained to do, which is why I'm a big advocate of partnering with experts and getting expertise and advice to help us do recovery ministry in a way that provides us support. Now, the things that I would hope and think that maybe recovery ministries could bring with them is this wonderful bridge to faith and a lack of shaming and blaming, a high priority of confidentiality, the capacity to embrace the 11th step with spiritual disciplines like prayer and meditation that are in keeping and supportive of the 11th step work for people who are working the 12, all that sort of thing. So I'm not saying we as faith-based communities don't also bring some strengths to the table, but we need to sort of humbly look at what we need to sort of up our game on. So I'm pretty passionate about that belief. We do not want to accidentally cause more harm, right? And even if we are not in a position or it's not part of our missional vision to help people with invitational interventions or interventions of any kind, I think we need to be able to have enough knowledge to reasonably assess the advice that treatment professionals are giving our folks, and to the best of our ability, support what they're learning so that they're not getting a bunch of confused messages. One practical way to do that is to establish some partnerships with people who have skill sets and often do things like writing behavioral contracts for families dealing with adolescents, or even spouses at times, or when we're doing an intervention. I think I've told you before that our community has partnerships like that, where a therapist, for example, will have their client who is a part of our community sign a release form so that we can work as a team. It doesn't happen with every person that therapist works with who comes into our community, but occasionally he feels like there's enough of a need for him to have some spiritual expertise that we work in tandem or in partnership when that seems necessary or helpful to the client that he has. So that's the kind of thing that I'm suggesting. Now, today I want to talk about interventions, but I want to set it against that backdrop that we are looking at interventions, but more than anything, we're trying to establish some gut awareness about what is healthy and principles and philosophies and that sort of thing in terms of dealing with it. This is complicated. It's hard. Interventions are difficult at best. And we have had some myths about what a good intervention looks like. I think we've talked about that before with what is actually detachment versus what is, I think we did this last time, end-stage codependent withdrawal. Traditionally, we've had television shows that have freaked us out with this tough love model where people write letters that I think seem to just shame the person to death and tell them all the ways that they've been a disappointment to us. I think that's horrible and it's not helpful. And the result of that is you can perhaps with enough leverage manipulate someone to go into treatment. But if you do it in a way that is disrespectful and shaming, the person goes into treatment and they spend all their time resenting you, and you provide them or the family that you're serving provides them with a lot of fodder and excuse for why they're not the problem, why their family looked mean or crazy. So tough love and the myths that we talked about in the first week or two need to be recalled here, and I'm going to get into them in a minute, and we need to fight against them. Love is tough. To love someone who is impaired is tough, but we need to be clear, respectful, and tender with them. And that's the differentiation as I see it. An invitational intervention has been around for quite a while. It's been modified and developed a lot. We got training on it, or several of us in our community got training on how to be a support for an invitational intervention. It was very helpful to us, and we've continued to learn more and more about it. So what we're suggesting is an invitational intervention, not a tough love intervention. An intervention that is step-by-step and systematic and is very respectful of the other person. It's not tricking them or scaring them, trying to scare them straight or anything like that. And I'm going to go over that in a minute. The other thing I want to say about an invitational intervention is it is, as most things, counterintuitive. So I like this quote a lot. The way out into the light often looks dark. The way that goes ahead often looks as if it went back. The way that is least hilly often looks as if it went up and down. The virtue that is really loftiness looks like an abyss. What is sheerest white looks sullied. And the thing that I love about that is I think it supports this idea that we have that this is a very counterintuitive process and that it's very hard sometimes to know what to do. That's why it's really important to get good strategic partnerships. That's why it's important to realize what our own limitations are. That's why it's important to understand that really there's a lot of finesse to doing an intervention. All right, let's look at some of the myths that stifle movement, just to review. I want you to know this stuff because I really would hope you'd never say it or never encourage anyone else to believe it. You don't have to be doing an intervention to be supportive of moving someone towards a healthier way to look at addiction treatment. And these myths get in the way of it, and it's sometimes easy to believe them because, you know, myths sound so true, right? And I think vocabulary can really help all of us. I just think it can, changing our vocabulary. So one of the myths that we've talked about before is you can't help a substance use disordered sufferer until he is ready. That would mean that no one would ever get help. Because of the nature of the affliction, people are rarely ready for help. And if they get ready for a moment or two, they rarely stay ready. It's a back and forth tug of war. And those of us who've had experience know this. So we have to really be careful to not buy into that there has to be readiness. What we need is willingness, not readiness. And willingness can be achieved more effectively if you and I have the tools we need to do so. Okay, here's something that feels true that almost never is. When we have a family that feels like they have been at this a long time, everyone, this is not a judgment, this is just the way it is. Everyone feels like they've tried everything. That is rarely true. So especially when you're dealing with a young adult, they need to have some form of treatment intervention, usually on the average of 6 or 7 times before it sort of clicks for them. People sort of practice stopping using. Now, like all of us, we tend to think, and a dad said this to me last Thursday night. So I had a family that we had done an intervention with, and we had been instrumental in sending their kid to 2 treatment facilities. First time he went to the first treatment facility, he relapsed 4 days when he got home. Everybody said, it didn't work. It was a waste. And I said, nope, it was our first attempt. I sent him to a different treatment facility the second time. Next time, he got in 6 solid months of sobriety before he relapsed. But when he relapsed, whoa, he did it right. I mean, big time relapse, got himself in a lot of trouble, got injured. A lot of bad stuff happened to him. It involved going to court. It involved being scared for his life. And then the third treatment facility was entered. He has now sustained 3 years of sobriety. And what one of his relatives told me recently was, well, I guess the third place took. That's a very common misconception, right? And it makes sense. The place you ended up, where you ended up getting sustained long-term recovery, it feels like that was the big win. But what we know is that each facility played its part in creating not only willingness, but readiness and developing skill sets. What if he had gone to the third place first? We'll never know the answer to that. But I think what research teaches us is it is usually the number of times so long as you're counting effective treatment. Now, let me put a little asterisk and a footnote to that. We have to understand what effective treatment is. So effective treatment is where we are treating mind, body, and spirit, where it is a full-time push while they are in treatment, at therapy, at group work, at educational skill development, at community building, at accountability, at psychological assessments, and all that sort of thing. So we need to know what the basics are for decent treatment. Now, I say that out of one side of my mouth, and then I'll say this other thing. Sometimes people find sobriety in what experts would say is not a good treatment facility. I hate to say that. I don't mean to sound judgy, but there are treatment facilities or places that call themselves treatment facilities that really aren't treating the affliction of substance use disorder. And we've got to keep that in mind. That doesn't mean that every once in a while the blind squirrel doesn't find a nut, but I would never suggest that we recommend somebody to call something that has not demonstrated that it has an effective treatment program modality based on the best practices and research that we know. I wouldn't recommend that. But then I thank God anytime anybody finds sobriety, even in a place that maybe I wouldn't recommend. Does that make sense? So we recommend, and sometimes I recommend strongly, but it's not mine to judge where families send people. Although I will give my opinion because that's the way I roll, right? There are times when people decide that it's none of their business. And although it is not up to us to control or cure, and we didn't cause, we can contribute either to the effectiveness or the wounding of a person who needs recovery. And so we are contributors if they are in our hut, if they are in our community, and if they're in our families. And it's our business to learn how to be better at being supportive and providing effective resources. The other myth is this sort of blame the victim mentality, where we say, well, they chose this. They choose this over and over and over again. They choose this. And you and I both know that that's not true. There comes a point where they lose choice. Treatment doesn't work. After all, we've tried it 2, 3, 4 times, and treatment doesn't work. Again, treatment is no guarantee, but what we know is we practice, and usually it eventually works for people. That's the usual. Treatment does work. It is just that what we call treatment is sometimes not treatment, and that makes it a little hairy to figure out. She has to hit her bottom. Again, we said, that is a false construct, and it's not helpful. What we need is somebody who is willing to follow suggestions for treatment. There is no magical bottom that somebody hits and they wake up one morning and go, wow, I should have had a V8. I can't wait to go to treatment. So let's just stop judging that and instead do the best we can to create willingness. One of my favorite phrases is, when opportunity decreases, willingness increases. And opportunity means that things have to be taken away from a person, right? It doesn't mean that we withdraw from them. It means that we detach and provide help and support in a way that's actually helpful and supportive. The other thing that is very disheartening and breaks down the effectiveness of any intervention is the erosion of integrity. And no, I'm not talking about the person with the substance use disorder, although that is also true. I'm talking about the family. that we begin to make choices that we just know aren't quite right. We do things we swore we were never going to do. This can also happen to those of us in leadership. We can begin to take shortcuts. We can begin to be less vigilant in doing our own work. We too can have an erosion of integrity. Working in recovery ministry is a lot like putting your finger in a light, an electrical outlet on a voluntary basis every day. You're just not sure which thing you do actually is going to get your finger stuck in the light socket. There's a lot of trauma and there's a lot of chaos involved. And we need to make sure that we're doing our work to maintain our integrity. Not our sense of, are we right? Not our sense of, are we even effective? Not our sense of whether somebody's even going to be helped by us or not. But literally, are we able, regardless of the outcome, to do the next right thing in terms of being helpful? And then there is this thing called unconscious collusion with the disease. So I had a mom call me up. It was maybe 3 years ago. It was the week before Thanksgiving. They were predicting a big rainstorm and she needed her kid in treatment ASAP. We talked through some options. The one she was considering wouldn't have been on my top 20 choice list. And finally I said, you know, better to choose well than quickly. And she says, I got to get him out of here by Friday. We're having company and it's going to rain. I don't want him on the streets, but I want him out of my house. This sort of reactionary, crisis-driven decision-making that sometimes says more about how tired we are than how well prepared we are is something we need to watch out for, whether we're the family member or whether we're the ministry leader who is trying to provide support. All right, so just as a sort of a mid-message break, there is this sense that we need to bear with the failings of the weak. And I think equally true, we need to be able and willing to acknowledge when we are the weak, right? So I think that that's really important. I pretty much feel weak every day. And I really love that verse in Corinthians that talks about when we are weak. That's kind of cool because God is strong. But there is this sense that we need to be people who can bear with the suffering of others in season or out, no matter who it is. And we need to do the work that can make that possible for us to do so. What I really love in all that is that I think invitational interventions are so much less stressful than this tough love model that some of us were brought up on. And I think personally that at the end of the day, we can feel a little bit better about who we are as ministry leaders. I think this model really fits with the gospel, and I quite love that. Maybe this would be a good time to talk about other options. So one of the things that when you're doing an invitational intervention, one of the things that I would hope we would all try to get improve our skill sets on is realizing that there are a lot of ways to skin this cat and that in-house treatment, expensive in-house treatment, can be a lovely option, especially if you're dealing with dual diagnosis. I think sometimes it's very helpful in those cases, especially, but also there are less expensive options like intensive outpatient, for example. Now, there's a lot of different philosophies and parents yell at me no matter which one I present. So I'll present several of options. You could decide to start slow and steady and build up to the howitzer big gun of expensive in-house treatment. You might first try going to 12-step meetings. You might try pairing attending 12-step meetings with getting a therapist. You might then try, if that's not helping, you might try getting a little bit more support. by going in and trying an intensive outpatient program. A lot of times that includes group work, therapeutic work, and 12-step meeting work. So that can be a good option, and it's usually less expensive. And then you begin to look at the inpatient options. Now, even expensive places can be less expensive. So we can encourage families to inquire about treatment facilities and also the availability of scholarships. What we've discovered here is that places that when they have a low bed count, when they happen to be at a time when they don't have a lot of clientele, will negotiate with families for rates. So you've got that going on too. And then there are no-cost treatment options, some of which are fantastic. I mean, I'm sorry not everybody doesn't live in Richmond, Virginia, but we have a no-cost treatment facility in Richmond called the Healing Place. It's got phenomenal records for those that graduate. It's just unbelievable. And they have a great system, and I love them, and I love the work they do. So this is an area where everybody's frustrated. But what I would say is a lot of times that frustration is more the direct result of just being afraid than being, I don't want to say legitimate, because there are some legitimate frustrations. And I don't want to sound all judgy about this, but it's important to really get to know your families and see if indeed they have been able to really actually dig in and do the consistent work that a family needs to do in terms of getting the help. Like the families consistently going to family education meetings. That's very important. Is the whole family getting some therapeutic support? That kind of thing. All right, you want to talk about invitational interventions? Let's roll. So an intervention team needs to be a group of people, and sometimes it's just two. A lot of times that's something Scott and I would do together. Needs to be able to accept any outcome. In other words, it's very important if you have a group of people helping a family navigate what it would look like to intervene on their beloved, that the intervention team doesn't get sucked into the vortex of the addictive family system or the dysfunctional family system. Same difference, really. Need to maintain that loving detachment that says, I'm here to be supportive, I'm here to be helpful. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, I can't cure it, but I want to be a contributor to recovery. And a lot of times this means building your own team, right? Having your own peeps that you call, your own therapist, your own addictionologist, or, you know, we have a whole host of people who are very gracious to us and allow us to call them and pick their brain on a regular basis. The other thing is with an invitational intervention, you want to be clear and committed. This is very hard for all of us not to get confused and a little off track. What is the thing that we need to do here? We need somebody who is in active substance use disorder at the far end, is behaving addictively. The first thing we need for them is sobriety. Families get really confused about it, and it's easy to get confused. Sometimes they think, well, they just need a job, or, man, I think we need that anxiety and depression managed. If I could just get a prescription for Klonopin, right? Now, do we sometimes need antidepressants or anxiety meds? Of course we do. But what we don't need is to get off track, that sobriety is still an important first priority, because it's hard to evaluate everything else when someone is impaired. We need to be able to communicate respectful, non-shaming, and non-coercive ways of inviting someone to get into treatment. Now, here's the bugaboo on this. It's very hard for somebody who is resisting what you're telling them to not feel disrespected, shamed, and coerced if what you're telling them is something that they don't agree on. So it's really hard. And so sometimes feelings are going to get hurt, and feathers are going to get ruffled, and we're going to get upset with each other. And we need to realize that we're not each other's enemies, but that in point of fact, the disease, the system, wants to sustain itself. So chaos and confusion is the name of the game. We need to be responsive and not reactionary. So the number one thing that happens in families is that they begin to move from crisis to crisis rather than coming up with a response that stays the same consistently throughout the highs and lows of the crises. We need a philosophy as a family of how we're going to respond, right? And we need to plan for that. We need to make sure it's well-researched so that we're convinced. We need to use our community for support and feedback, who have a lot of expertise in this field, all that good stuff. But what we're working for is a strategic plan that is responsive, not reactionary. One of the things that I hear Scott say often when he's working with families in this situation is, I'm trying to understand what you as a family can tolerate. In other words, there are many, you know, kind of responsive things that we would say to a family that are just very general truths. Like, for example, I probably don't think a 17-year-old with a substance use disorder should be given a car. I don't know. It just seems like you're putting a weapon of mass destruction in an impaired person's reach, right? But if the family can't tolerate that counsel, after you've said it once, twice, three times if you're charming, move on. They can't tolerate that good counsel. Maybe there's something else that you can suggest that would be helpful that they can tolerate. So this is what we do as leadership in terms of trying to say, hey, look, where is that quote? I can accept any outcome here. It's not about me being right or wrong or changing anyone's mind. I serve as a supportive resource. I'm going to give you what I think you can tolerate, even though I'm going to try to give you my best practice advice every time. Dr. Vernon Johnson has said that anyone who sincerely wants to help can help. Chances are that anyone is able to do an intervention. However, if you feel the need for assistance, you should seek it. He also has in the parentheses there, or if someone suggests that you might need that level of support. I think sometimes we don't know what we need until it's given to us, right? I think we all need a high level of support. We might even be able to be really clear about somebody else's family, but I would just say I'm rarely clear about my own. And I'm just assuming that's true of everybody, or maybe I'm the only one with the problem. So I think that Dr. Johnson is saying is true if we do the good work we need to do in order to figure out how to intervene in a way that is helpful, supportive, and effective. And come on, we all know it's really hard to figure that out, right? So what I'd say is it really takes a village and a lot of collaboration. Here is something that I would look for in assessing family willingness. Do families go to meetings? Now look, not all meetings are for everyone, but everyone can find a meeting, right? So there's Al-Anon, there's CODA, there's Families Anonymous. In our community, we have found that people seem to be kind of resistant to the support groups. So we've looked around and said, there are tons of support groups in our community. And we also have some of those. But what could we add? So we added something that I encourage every church to do, which is create a weekly family education program where you bring experts in from the field of research, addiction treatment, dual diagnosis, therapy, all that sort of stuff, to sort of supplement what you're doing as a faith-based community and provide education that is supportive for the family members. I think that's something we could all do. But really, we need to look. Are families attending meetings for themselves, helping them stay clear? Are we reading and researching and studying and considering? Can we find a therapist experienced in addiction recovery, not only for our loved one, who may or may not be ready for that level of treatment, they may be better suited for a group meeting, but for ourselves? If we need to, are we willing to hire an interventionist? And do we have access to a recovery ministry, or are we supporting the work of recovery in our community so that others can have that same access? Collaboration is the key. I think it's just so super duper important. I can't even stress it enough. Mainly what I want to move us through and close with is sort of thinking about having an attitude adjustment. So here's the thing. When we're working with families in crisis, they are moving from what appears to be one acute crisis to another, right? But what we're really dealing with is a very chronic problem. If you break your arm, that's an acute crisis. Everybody jumps up and down, runs to the ER, gets a cast, and then maybe in a week goes back and sees the orthopedic specialist to make sure everything's cool. And then in 6 or 8 weeks, you get the cast off. And maybe if you're an old person like me, you add a little physical therapy to it and it's done. And the broken arm in the end is stronger for the break, where the break happened, than it was beforehand. I don't know. That's mysterious, right? I don't know how that works. But this is a chronic problem, and families often respond as if it's acute and a crisis. So they reach out for help when they're in the middle of the crisis rather than in a very steady, intentional way, day by day, week by week, getting educated, staying educated, acquiring the language, getting the support so that there's no crisis, but that but that each crisis is met with a reasonable level of calm, because you're building up a little bit of confidence that you know what you're going to do, and you've already got a plan for some contingencies in terms of treatment options. You're not scrambling, nor are you throwing good money after bad. If you're seeing something's not working, you don't just double down on that. We have a phrase for that, right? Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So we need to be thinking that we've got a chronic issue, that we're going to be very intentional in the treatment of it, that we're going to be productive both in behavior and thought. This requires a lot of help, because just as we've talked about, the substance use disorder person's midbrain is in hyperdrive, and they're feeling like this is survival for them to use this substance. Well, we think it's survival for us, for them to stop using the substance. So we may be spending a lot of time thinking and doing very unproductively. So we need to move the needle on that and move towards productive behavior and productive thinking. I have never seen a family that does well without a very good support team, one that is outside their closest sphere of influence. Just like I don't think families can be the primary support for someone with a substance use disorder. I think they get their support in their meeting room and with their therapist and with their doc. Families need to be supportive, but they can't provide the kind of accountability in many ways and support that a good sponsor can, or an excellent therapist, or a good addiction doc. We need to have the courage to carry through on on our convictions. We need to move very consistently with carrying through. So often I see a repetition of enabling behaviors, right? What we do is we make things just comfortable enough for our beloved so that they don't have to make any change. They get very used to living in a box, just so long as we throw them some hamburgers in there and some fries once in a while, right? Metaphorically speaking. So it's very important that we're carrying through in a way that allows them to see the wisdom of getting treatment. This is always a spiritual negotiation. This is the place where I think faith-based communities can be so, so helpful. Now, faith-based communities can be harmful too by super spiritualizing something, by always throwing spiritual language at something when a different language would have been better. But a spiritual negotiation often is occurring within us, where we are, wasn't it Beth who said that we are at some point having to trust our beloveds to God, right? And have that kind of peace. So it's a spiritual negotiation on our part, and it's a and whether they realize it or not, that is true for them as well. All of us, every single one of us, created in the very image of God, we know that this is a spiritual negotiation. What we're looking for is the family winning, the user winning, and the disease losing. So we don't want to pit ourselves against one another. Find a way to stand with the user and with the family and not collude with the disease. It's possible to be assertive and loving at the same time. I'm not very good at it. I kind of freak out. But you can find someone on your team who is calm and is lovingly assertive. In our community, his name is Scott. He manages to stay very calm. Meanwhile, I'm freaking out and using cuss words. The other thing to remember in our attitude adjustment is that we're coming at the core of everything we're doing, we're coming as ambassadors of Christ. I don't want to super spiritualize this to the point where it becomes spiritually abusive, but if we are people of faith, we have an integrity issue if we are not living by our core values as it relates to our faith, treating everyone with dignity and respect, and all the things that go along with that. Now, in saying that, I have found this to be working in recovery ministry to be a great place that requires me over and over again to ask myself, what do I believe and why do I believe it? And I find myself sometimes adjusting my understanding of what it means to be an ambassador. The other thing is, I think we need to prepare. We need to have a team approach. We need to brainstorm objectives. We need to choose a team lead if there's going to be a physical intervention. We need to determine the bottom line that everyone can tolerate. And we need to be clear about the negative consequences of the disease to inspire the family to stand firm in what their bottom line is. And we need to be very aware of what our own weaknesses are. On our team, Scott knows mom might freak out. I know that sometimes I have resources. So we have strengths and weaknesses. This thing about writing intervention letters needs to be done with care. We're going to talk about that next time. And should not be done without a lot of adult supervision. And we need to rehearse.